Here I was committed to dropping the two brothers routine, and over here they asked me, are there now four brothers? Now that's for our generational panel that we're going to have this morning in a minute. What's the connection between Walk Through the Bible and Dallas Seminary? I mean, the other three speakers are all on seminary staff. How did I end up here? Well, there would not be a Walk Through the Bible Ministries without Dallas Seminary. In the mid-70s, a seminary student by the name of Bruce Wilkinson, he and his classmates were working on what really was the prototype for the walk through the Old Testament, of taking hand signs and putting them with major people, events, and places. And it was a creative idea, and they made some progress. But then Bruce asked permission, may I do this for my master's thesis, for my big capstone project? And his advisors said okay, and I wasn't there. I was in high school at the time, but evidently he stretched wires across this room and had all these overhead transparencies, remember those things, clothespin, and he was zipping them across, and I guess it was quite a performance. Gene Getz was one of his readers, Dr. Howard Hendricks also, and at the end of this amazing presentation of this is how to teach people the overview of the scriptures, Dr. Hendricks, always practical, says, does it work? And I used to feel bad imitating him until his wife, Jean, came to one of our major donor conferences a few years ago because I had dedicated my second book to Prof. Hendricks and we wanted to give her the first copy. And she goes, you are going to imitate my husband, aren't you? I miss his voice so. And I'm like, that may be entrapment. And so I snuck in a couple times, and here come my board members going, you are aware that Howard Hendricks' widow is present in there. I was like, she told me to, really. And I'm not sure they still believe me. But anyway, Prof. Hendricks goes, go try it in five churches, then I'll grade it. And he did, and it worked, and his intention was never to launch a ministry. He wanted to be a Bible college professor, maybe eventually a Bible college president, and God had a different idea than having a place that everyone comes to have tools that would be, you know, mobile. And now in 139 countries, and hopefully a couple more that the Lord will help us open up this year, wouldn't exist without the greenhouse of Dallas Seminary. I'm telling you, there's no better place that you could invest your resources than with Dallas Seminary, because it's still functioning as a greenhouse for the next generation of men and women who have creative ideas like that, and with a little encouragement and some really wise people coming alongside of them, who knows what the next great idea is going to be. And Chip Ingram, who is the second president of Walk Through the Bible, leads Living on the Edge, great Bible teacher, also a Dallas Seminary graduate. And now as our third president, I'm also a DTS grad. So you can't separate Walk Through the Bible from Dallas Seminary. So I may occasionally actually mention Walk Through the Bible, realize we go back to our parent, which is Dallas Seminary. So pretty cool. Today we're going to be talking about the generations. Did anybody not have a workbook? My wife is waving one at me in the back. Raise your hand. Here's a lady up here. A couple folks up here. There's several around. And keep your hands up and the people will find you. It's pretty cool when ushers give you stuff instead of take money. It's kind of a nice twist. There's a bunch up here, hon. So there's about 10 people up here. So we're busting open another case. There we go. Okay, just be patient. While we're doing that, how many of you were with Steve Hopper yesterday for Walk Through the New Testament? Okay, great. One of the things that group saw is something called the keyword learning system. And here's what that is. We developed this just for our instructors. Take the name of a Bible book, what the book's about, put them together in a picture lock it in your memory. My kids very early on could go Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Kings, you know, well, that's great. But what's in the books? Where do you look when you want to find different things? And so some really creative people came up with these ideas. We drank Jolt Cola, which has like 3 times the caffeine of Coca-Cola. And we turned on the tape recorder years ago, and we captured some amazing stuff, and then artists turned them into pictures. Here's the first one. Now, what book is this? All right, as teachers all know, you begin with something easy to build early confidence in the learners, and they will get more difficult. What do you notice about Genesis? What's strange? N. What about the N? It's big, because Genesis is a book of big endings. Oh, no, pace yourself. They will become much worse, trust me. So if you wanted to read about the beginning of the whole world, the fact that God doesn't have a beginning because he's eternal, the beginning of sin, the beginning of God's efforts to reach out and call us back into a relationship with himself, there's the book you go to. What book is this? Next. Also, pretty much a gimme. Guess what the key word for Exodus is? This is not the average group here. You're just... I got the gifted section to teach. Yay. And they make their exit out of Egypt under Moses' leadership. You'd think they would be smiling, but if you look closely, some of them are frowning. Do you know why that is? They miss their mummies. That's right. Mark Bailey taught me that one when he trained me years ago. I thought it's Sphinx, but I use it anyway. So let's do another one. That's the book of what part of the house? The book of Ruth, more commonly called the book of Ruth. And they're not on the first story, they're on the second story, which is the love story. How can I begin to tell the story of how great a love can be? It's about God's love for Naomi and Ruth. It's about Boaz's love for Ruth. She changed his life. Prior to that, he was ruthless. And that relationship transformed him. It's about Ruth's love for her mother-in-law. So it's a supernatural book. There's miracles in here. So Ruth, love story. Let's try another one. That guy on the bottom right, what is he doing? He's bowing, but he's kissing. What's he kissing? His foot. Which foot? So make it a sentence. He's giving his left foot a kiss. You're ahead of us. The well-known book of Left Foot a Kiss. Some pronounce it Leviticus, which is about the offerings and feasts. 5 offerings, 7 feasts, 12 ways to communicate their gratitude to God. Now, there's many deep truths hidden in these pictures. For instance, have you ever wondered who got to be the Levites? This cartoon answer, it's based on their genes. So there you go. Those turned out to be too good for our couple hundred instructors, so now they come as flashcards, as coloring books, and you can pretend you're buying them for your grandkids if you still like to color. Our kids grew up on these things, and even today, if I would say to Emily, not just quiz her on these because she's got a ridiculous memory, but suppose she had a friend who was struggling and thought there was no way out, what would be an encouraging book to get your friend to read? And she'd roll her eyes, and I'd go, no, really? And she'd go, Exodus, exit, there's always a way out, God can deliver. That probably got locked into her mind about age 12. And we've received thank you notes from pastors who go, I would have bombed my ordination exam without your little coloring book. Somebody asked me the message of Habakkuk, and I'm like, ha, backpack, that guy, saw the cartoon, and he's on a watchtower watching what, I'm like, you're welcome. Okay, I think that's all of them. Is that all of them? Oh, no, we have bonus land here. What animal is this? donkey. Now, remembering that you're almost in church, carefully give me another name for a donkey. No, not that one, the other one. Stubborn as a mule, and I know they're not the same, okay, but it's close enough. What's this mule made of? So it's a? There's one of them, so it must be the book of 1 Samuel. It's obviously about one of Israel's kings, but which king? What's he holding? Saul, who had no heart for God. No, it's over on the sleeve, but it's not real. All right, so today, we're going to talk about the generations. We talked yesterday about, don't show them that yet, take that down. They'll peek and get ahead. We talked yesterday about the parallels between Josiah and today's millennials, the 18 to 38-year-old young adults. Several of you asked, what comes after that? They're calling it Gen Z. We haven't put it in our book yet because I think it's not exactly responsible to tell an entire generation who's still in their teens to tell them this is who you are. I think that's, you know, it's no problem to do some teaching on it, but we didn't want to break them down and go, this is your column of the chart. Obviously, all of this is an oversimplification. It's a summary. But I don't know about you, but I hear all those names, baby boomers and builders and Gen X, and they kind of all fly past my head. And so one of the things we wanted to do in this course is just put in a parenthesis and go, let's talk about the generations. And it's really cool. Every country we're in, when they print their workbooks, or at least region, they have to do their own chart because our charts don't fit, and some don't even use the word millennial, though that's pretty global media-wise. I'm going to go ahead and warn you up front, we're not going to open our Bibles and look at the scriptures in this session. I am president of Walk Through the Bible. I would like to continue in that role. I'm a card-carrying DTS alum, and I have a very high view of scripture, I think you know from previous teaching. But one of the things that I was told in school is that as preachers, we are to be bridge builders from the Word of God, which was written in Bible times, to today, and without compromising the message of scripture, to make sure that it gets communicated in such a way that it's able to be understood by our culture. And I don't know who said it, but I remember somebody saying, and it when they said it, it stung, said, way too many pastors know more about first century AD Ephesus than they know about 21st century Dallas, Atlanta, Washington, D.C., Moscow. And we are to be bridge builders. And so we're going to spend time on this half of that bridge today and get to know these generations. If you have your workbook, go ahead and open it up. On page 20 is a chart. I tell you that not so that you can read ahead and learn this and compare the answers. If you're on my panel, don't even look at that chart because I don't care what the chart says. I want to hear what you say. But I say that so you know you've already got this in print, all right? So you don't have to feverishly try to write all this down. I want you to hear the stories of four people who represent these different generations. We have, first of all, our builder. And as you see on the chart there, builders were born between the years what and what? 1922 to 1943. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be on my panel, but if you are, that's a bonus. Where is Bill? Bill was one of the designers of the landing craft of the lunar module or something? The what?
Landing system.
Will you welcome Bill, please? Will you take that left seat for us there? I got a really intelligent panel here, if you haven't figured that out. Then representing the baby boomers, where is Dave? Dave, come on up. And then representing Gen X is Wendy Davis here today. Oh, she had something come up and she couldn't make it. I take volunteers, but is she there? Wendy, there you are. Come on down. Give Wendy a hand. This is what happens if you ask the speaker questions after the sessions. Then we need a millennial. We've been talking about him all week. Where is Jill Hatterberg? Or not Hatterberg, Harris. We welcome Jill, please. Look at this panel we have here. I'm going to let you two share this microphone. And Wendy and Jill, you can share that one. Don't heckle each other. Be nice. Play nice. But I just want to ask them some questions because I want to take what's a cold chart on a page and I want you to hear it in terms of people's actual experience. What's this have to do with what we were learning? Because our lack of understanding of the generational issues causes big problems in churches. I was talking to a guy already today, and a church he was part of once is a, like a lot of churches that I've been associated with through the years, their solution to it is you just break people out in groups of their own age. Well, there's a cost when you do that. I was part of a young married Sunday school class. We were all young parents by about this time, and we were using some really great stuff by Dennis Rainey. It's good material. And at one point, after about a year and a half, somebody goes, okay, but like none of us in this room have successfully gotten through potty training. I go, well, I have. And they go, well, your daughter hasn't. I go, oh, you're talking about her. Okay, good. They said, do you think we could have a guest speaker of somebody like who lived to tell about that? And I go, what a great idea. And after a while, there's nothing wrong with having a young marriage class, but you don't want to just pool your collective ignorance. The generations need each other. Certainly younger need older, but guess what? Older need younger too. So this is a deeply spiritual lesson in that way. All right, William, do you go by Bill or William?
Bill.
Bill, okay. Everybody say, hi, Bill.
Hi.
All right, Bill, one of the things that you'll see in here, and again, you can follow along in your workbook, but I don't want to just see the tops of your heads. I want you to look eye to eye with these folks. So one of the things we talk about is how each generation has defining events. What year were you born?
36.
Talking
about 1936.
Okay, so that's perfect. You're right in that range there. Great Depression before you, but probably influenced your home and its values. What was the attitude toward money and resources in the home you grew up in?
We didn't have a lot of money, but we did okay. My father was a body and paint man, and so he didn't really know a depression because people couldn't afford new cars, so they fixed up the old ones.
That works. Okay. But by the time World War II comes, you would have memories of that time as a young boy, correct?
Yes.
What comes to mind when you think of World War II?
My father was in the Navy and gone a long time.
Wow. See, the next guy's a pastor. The answers will be longer. So whatever time Bill doesn't use, he'll yield to...
Didn't want to overuse my time.
So during World War II, I mean, it was before my birth, but one of the things I've heard from so many people is everybody, even here at home, everybody was involved in the war effort. For your family who was here, how did that manifest itself?
Well, it's interesting because, in a sense, my brother and I were involved. At age 6 and he at age 8, they were encouraging everybody to have a victory garden. So we became entrepreneurs and bought packages of seeds in a big box and then went around door to door selling flower seeds and vegetable garden seeds.
Wow. Where did your father serve? You said Navy.
He was in the South Pacific.
Oh, man. And he did come home.
He did come home.
Wow, thankful for that. My dad also fought in World War II. He lost his best friend in World War II. And lost a lot of the unit that he was a part of. But that generation grew up really quickly, didn't they?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. Sorry about that.
I will validate that experiment. Yes. You know, I mean, my dad got an opportunity he wouldn't have had to go to college on the GI Bill. And, you know, again, they came home, some of them at, you know, early 20s, and what they'd seen and what they've, some of you in this room. We may have a handful of World War, do we have any World War II vets here? Raise your hand. Okay, if I'd asked that question 5 years ago, there'd have been a lot of hands.
Yeah.
I mean, we're now down well under a million World War II vets. If you have some of these in your family, you need to interview them. My dad would never talk about World War II. And when my son came along, he'll tell my son anything. So I kind of sit there while Philip interviews him. I remember one time I'm texting Philip questions that I'd always wanted to know. And my dad would tell him anything. It was amazing. We found out he won the Bronze Star. Never talked about that. Never talked about other things. And anyway. Well, pass the mic over there. Dave, for you representing the baby boomers, and you're kind of on the young side of the baby boomers, but I told him to pretend he's a little older today. He said that would not be a problem. Do you remember where you were when you heard that President Kennedy was assassinated?
Well, that's probably one of the defining events of our generation, but I was a little bit young. I was 5 years old. I remember Bobby Kennedy, and I remember Martin Luther King Jr., and those kinds of things a little bit better, but I was 5 years old when that happened, and so, I don't really remember that, or even where I was or anything, but my parents sure do, and they talk about that on occasion, especially since my dad was in the military, and so, you know, it was obviously a big deal at the time.
Mm. When we did the DVD series of this, the guy who was supposed to be my baby boomer canceled, like, the night before. I'm like, no, and he goes, I got another guy for you. Turned out to be a guy named Julian, and he's in, like, school administration, and he said in our home, Julian's African-American, he says, in our home, there were only two pictures on the wall. One was John F. Kennedy, one was Martin Luther King. And he says, we draped John F. Kennedy's picture when he died, and then Martin Luther King Jr. died on my 11th birthday, Julian said. And he goes, I've never enjoyed a birthday since then. It was that traumatic. Civil rights movement came as something that you experienced. I don't know how big a community you grew up in, or how did that rapidly changing situation affect you? Do you remember?
Well, it was always something that was on our minds and something that was on the television all the time. That's where we were kind of glued every night and watching the outcome of some of those things. We lived in Reno, which wasn't, there wasn't a lot of civil rights issues going on there, but we were sure following what was going on in Washington, D.C. and throughout the country, and it was just pretty overwhelming to watch. But, you know, growing up in the 60s and things like that, all of the music, all the rock and roll, you know, one of the defining moments of our generation probably was in 1970 when those great theologians, the Beatles, you know, broke up. And that was pretty traumatic, I think, for a lot of people, just because they were kind of the voice of a whole generation in responding to the civil rights movement and a lot of the things that were going on in the country at the time. Mm-hmm. A lot of other groups followed in the wake of that. And so, unfortunately, I think it just caused us to question a lot of things as far as what they were bringing up.
Right. And you had also Vietnam as well. And again, not the unity as a country that there was in World War II. Some of you were probably on different sides of that debate. Wendy, she's got one. Representing Generation X, this is the hardest generation to go, oh, that's the event. One of the ones that we didn't put on here, but I'll bet you remember when the space shuttle blew up. Do you?
I do.
Oh, no, don't. Don't be Bill.
Yeah.
Be halfway between Bill and Dave. We got two words from her. I do. So talk about your memories of that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember watching it on, you know, TV. I remember being stunned. I just remember being more of a spectator.
Yeah. I was home studying that morning, and Ellen came in just in tears, and we were in that little country town. We got one channel on our televisions, and she's like, turn on the TV, and I'm like, what? And, we had just gotten comfortable enough with space travel that you didn't even know when there was a shuttle up there, and that rocked all of our world. You're in your generation, you had a number of experiences that were disillusioning, whether that was political figures whose character deeply disappointed, and also religious leaders. Do you? I knowing you a little bit personally, as of 2 days ago, we go way back, but I don't sense like cynicism in you, but it's pretty common in that generation. Do you remember feeling let down by authority figures? I know your mom and dad, so you didn't have it there, but
yeah. No, I didn't, because I think that I guess as a believer that wasn't where I put my that wasn't where I fixed my eyes and put my hope.
Yeah.
And so I knew that they were whether they were in government or whatever, but I guess I didn't put expectations on them. So
it's really great.
I don't think I was, like that when, I mean, we're disappointed when people disappoint us, but I think they were, I don't know, I just didn't put my hope in them.
I was at a homeschool conference in Colorado this year, big, several thousand people, and I thought, oh man, where am I going to find a homeschool mom who's like got a problem with authority? Good luck. And I just kind of, and I didn't know anybody going into this conference. And so I picked a woman and she sat in your seat. And I said, okay, I'm maybe not speaking for yourself, but the whole idea of question authority. I said, do you have friends? And she goes, oh man. She goes, it's not my friends. She says, my father was one of the top five leaders in the American Communist Party. And she goes, to this day, even though I'm a committed Christ follower, she goes, it was just drilled in me early to not trust any authority. Hmm. And I'm like, praise God, you took care of me. But yeah, Jill, I bet you remember where you were on 9/11.
Yes.
Probably all do, but.
Yes, I do. So for fifth and sixth grade, all three out of us four kids were homeschooled. So at the time I was home, just kind of starting to get ready. We had a church co-op that we would go to. So I remember walking into my parents' room and seeing the small TV that there was breaking news. And, in my 10 or 11 years until then, there had never been anything that dramatic. So to look at the TV screen and see the images that were so disturbing as an 11-year-old was pretty new. So I just remember, getting in the car on our way to co-op and listening to the news the whole time. And then getting to the church and walking past one of the offices and seeing the TV screen and seeing those same images. So, the parents were flustered. The kids didn't really know what was going on. And so I remember us like trying to get work done for that afternoon, like working on our school books, and then coming home, turning the news back on, seeing those same images, seeing kind of the collateral damage and everything that was happening afterwards. I think for me, what I remember the most was that night. We were all just exhausted, just emotionally exhausted. We had never seen anything like this. I had never seen anything like this. And to see my parents so discouraged and to see our family just so confused about what was going on. And we had some family in New York at the time, so just making sure they were okay. And it, for me, wow. It felt like everyone knew someone in New York, or so everyone knew someone who was potentially affected.
Right.
And our neighbors knew someone in New York. So it was just, it was hard to see it, like, not so close, because it was on the TV, but, like, everyone knew someone.
Yeah.
So I think that was the hardest
part. We watched
it
in real time, remember that? I mean, I heard the news, and I'm like, somebody's like, it was a big airplane. I'm like, no, it wouldn't be a big airplane. It was probably a private plane. Guy made a mistake. And we went to a TV in time to see the second plane hit the tower. You know, we didn't watch World War II in real time. You could go and see the movie reels, you know, in the theaters. But this was such a different experience as a result of that. Do you remember where you were when the Navy SEALs took out Bin Laden? Or do you remember hearing about that?
I remember it happening. I don't remember where I was.
Do you remember what you felt?
I felt like I was supposed to feel relief. I didn't really know much about it because most of it was from the news and what I had seen. But I remember people around me being relieved. So just kind of the sense of like, okay, maybe stuff like 9/11 won't happen again if
See,
guys like that are
the
gone.
There's the statement right there.
Yeah.
9/11 brought fear into the world of this generation. It rocked all of us, but especially all of a sudden our world wasn't safe anymore. And the night that Bin Laden was killed, there was like this party broke out outside the White House, and there were people in trees and they were cheering. And I looked at it, and they were millennials. And I asked my daughter, I said, what do you think of that? And she goes, I'm really torn, because as a Christian, I have trouble rejoicing that somebody's dead and hell probably got one more resident. But she says, but as a person, she goes, all that you're seeing, Dad, is like Ding Dong, the Wicked Witch is dead. And there's, she used the same word, relief. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Man, we could stay on this row for a long time. You've seen big differences in families through the years. Bill, when you were growing up, how common was divorce?
Pretty uncommon. It was one of those things you more read about or heard about, and didn't really see any of my family until later years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. May not mean couples were necessarily happy, but the less marriages broke up. Dave, what about when we get to your generation?
Well, it was still fairly uncommon, but it was very common in my family, because my grandfather, that I really looked up to as long as I could remember, he and my grandmother were both divorced. They were divorced from each other. And so, but then they got remarried, then they got divorced again, then they got remarried, then they got divorced again. And then, kind of funny how these things run in families, because then my dad and my mom got divorced and they got remarried. I got to be the best man at my parents' wedding. It was pretty cool. Yeah.
Whoa. you don't know how much I'm dying to dig into that topic, but we can't. Wendy, probably, again, I know your folks, but probably a lot more common in your growing up years, or you didn't feel it much?
No, I didn't feel that way.
I want to grow up where she grew up.
My uncles, they were, you know, they had divorces in there, but that was, as far as the family, yeah, several uncles went through different marriages, but I feel like of the families that I knew, it wasn't common, and it was, I remember when I was in junior high, and a friend's parents got divorced after they'd been married for 18 years, and I remember being shocked, you know, and so it did kind of rock my world that it wasn't the common thing, you know, around growing up. So.
And in that way, in some ways, you're not typical of your generation. You would find the merged or blended families. One of the things that Mount Hermon does, if this has touched your family, you may want to know about this. When then there's a remarriage and you bring two families together, not the same ones taking a second or third lap, but you know, that's whose discipline style are we going to use and all of that. And Mount Hermon has an excellent conference later in the summer, early fall, on blended families. And it's, again, it's something that wouldn't even have been a topic earlier, but man, it's highly relevant now. Jill, when we get to you, it's not just it's not just blended families and merged families and all, but it's what is a family?
Yeah.
Wax eloquent on that one for us.
I would say in our church community, we didn't see much divorce, or in our close community, we didn't see much divorce. Growing up in public school, it might have been, it wasn't as talked about, but it was much more common. Yeah. To have single moms and, you know, on soccer teams, only seeing someone's mom there, only seeing someone's dad there, and wondering, you know, growing up in a community where I usually saw two parents, to see one, to see how that affected my friends. A lot of anger, a lot of frustration, mm-hmm. a lot of confusion.
Mm-hmm. And now in more recent years, is it two moms? Is it two dads? I mean, what is a family? Now I need your short answers. So, Bill, man, this is your time. Something huge happens, and you, earlier on growing up or even as a young adult, your extended family who are scattered all over America need to hear about it. How did you tell them about that? How did you share big news of something in your family? How did you communicate it?
Of course, in those days, you used the old telephone, but...
See, he's ahead of himself. The correct answer is we wrote letters. But that's okay. that's okay.
Me, not so much.
Yes, he's progressive. I know. My parents, we would have one phone call a week in college, and, you know, because it cost money, and they'd say, how were your classes? I go, nothing to write home about. And my mom would go, apparently not much is. Because they were deeply troubled. They couldn't believe I didn't write regular letters. And it's been fun around the world. In Ghana in February, I asked the gentleman here, I said, and I was sure I had to write it, like I thought I'd get with you, Bill. We wrote letters. And he goes, never wrote a letter. And I go, really? He goes, drums. I go, drums? And he says, you shared it between villages, and every village had their own pitch of drums. And I'm like, oh, baby. And I said, what about if you were fighting with your neighboring village? He goes, then you'd send the messenger. You'd always send the messenger with two witnesses. And I said, wow. And then we get to Dave's generation, and by now the telephone is getting a lot more common, but it was a telephone on the wall, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which to Jill's generation, that freaks them out. I saw a cartoon with two cell phones standing next to each other, and they're looking at a picture of a wall phone on the wall, and it says, yes, believe it or not, our ancestors had tails. It's pretty cool. But telephone for you, right?
Yeah.
More common.
Yeah.
We get to Wendy, and we have the invention of email.
Right?
Right, email.
Okay. Jill, how much do you use email?
Only for business.
Only for business. Hear that? How do you communicate if it's personal?
Text. Or, yeah, mainly text.
Text, social media, sometimes cell phone, yeah. We had to learn to text when our kids went away to college. It was like if we wanted to hear from them, we had to do this. There is a downside to older people using new technology. Like this guy with the drums, I said, then did you use the telephone? Nope. He says, we had telegraph, but it was just like little drums that weren't very loud. I'm like, I see what you mean. And I said, so what do you use now? And he reaches in his pocket, and he pulled out an iPhone 8. He jumped straight from the drums to a smartphone. I'm like, whoa. I'm taking a risk by sharing this story. Okay, I will do it discreetly. You fill in the blanks. But our kids are away at college. I'm at work. I've gotten most of what I need to get done that day. Ellen's at home. And I took out my iPhone and I texted her a suggestion of how the afternoon might more enjoyably be invested than her at home and me at work. I'd just gotten back from a trip. Don't make me connect the dots. It wasn't inappropriate, but I wasn't taking any chances of her not knowing what I meant either. So I text this, and about a nanosecond later, my son responds. and says, "Dad, I'm in Bible class." He goes, "We're not studying Song of Solomon." He's like, "Learn how to use your phone." And I just about sent you something that belonged to somebody else today, but never with those consequences. And I go, "What's the chance this stays with us?" And it was only a nanosecond between send and the response. He goes, "Too late, already forwarded it to Emily." We went up there for a ball game later, and everybody's in the dugout baseball game, and they all turn, and for some reason, Philip's friends have all called me Rev T. I've never been a reverend. They just started that, and it went from high school to college. The whole team, like, turns around, and several of them are nodding, and they're like, this is a couple months later, and they're like, "Rev T, you and the missus still got it going, yeah." So embrace the new technology, use it carefully, okay? Okay. When this group, especially, it's over now, move on. Everybody's giving consolation to my wife. She didn't know what she was signing on for when she said yes. But in Bill's generation, you know, that group grew up quickly. Responsibility would be the key word of that generation. My dad, when he retired from State Farm, the president of State Farm was there and said, "Today ends a streak that would make Cal Ripken jealous." He said, "Typhoid Tuttle," they called him, worked 36 and a half years without a sick day. Doesn't mean he was never sick. In fact, the president says, "Overall, I think the health of our company will now improve now that Typhoid Tuttle is gone." 2 weeks later, he had a hernia surgery, and the doctor goes, "How long has this been bothering?" He goes, "I don't know, 2-3 years maybe. They don't pay me to stay home. I'm thankful to have a job. They recruited me out of college." You get to the next generation, still very hardworking, but you begin to hear work smarter, not harder. The emphasis on productivity, not just activity. We come here, and by this time, the link between loyalty between individual employees and the company begins to fall apart. My brother, he's 70, so he's more over there, but he still has a pension. I don't have a pension. He got a cost of living raise last year for doing nothing but having a pulse. I'm a little bitter about that. But now, you know, you got to do your 401k, you got to do your 403b, is it not? You got to provide for yourself. You get over here, and the gold standard of millennials is authenticity. If your church is hemorrhaging this younger generation, likely why it is, you may have fixed your music, you may have started wearing jeans to go to church. If it's not real, they're gone. If every illustration the pastor shares, he's on the big white horse riding off into the sunset, they're like, "I don't believe him. I don't believe him." I spoke at Gordon College in Boston a few years ago, and at the end of the year, the chaplain called me and goes, "Hey, congratulations, you made the top five." I said, "What's the top five?" He says, "We interview students at the end of the year. We do a survey. Who were your favorite speakers? And those we invite back. You made the top five. Get out your calendar." And I go, "Well, that's great." He goes, "You want to know something weird?" He goes, "You're the only one in the top five under 80 years old." And I said, "How many chapel speakers over 80 did you have?" He goes, "Four." He goes, "Good thing for you, or we wouldn't be talking right now." And I go, "Gary, you got to explain that. What's the deal?" And he says, "Most of our students believe their parents have exchanged real biblical Christianity for the American dream." And he says, "But they look at their grandparents, and they're like, now they're real." And I go, "How'd I sneak into that group?" And he goes, I think you act really old." And I'm like, "Thank you." And he goes, "No." He goes, "Remember, you were here like 4 days." He goes, "Your wife came with you. She still laughs at your really sad jokes. You didn't speak and run and hide. You hung out in the dining halls. You spent evenings in the dorms." And she goes, he says, I think they think you're real. So get out your calendar. That's a lesson for all of us. When we filmed this, I asked the gentleman here, John Frank Diegues, I said, if you could have lunch with any of these three people, who would you choose? I thought he'd dodge the question. He didn't. He pointed at the end, a mutual friend of Mark and Hattie and me, and says, Maggie. And Maggie goes, early on they'd had an exchange. John Frank goes, I've never received a letter. Never received a personal letter in my life. Says, it's just marketing. I hardly even look at it. And Maggie goes, that's wrong. And they're now pen pals, which is pretty cool. The attraction. So why do I tell you that? Because those of you in this room who are older, some of you who are thinking that I don't have much productive ministry anymore, I'm telling you, and you better believe me, Jill's generation is hungry for mentoring. And mentoring doesn't mean you did it all right. Mentoring just means you survived walking through a minefield that they're now entering, and you can point some places they don't want to step out, and you can love them, and you can encourage them, and you better start with your own grandkids. But many people don't live near their grandparents anymore, right? So they need adopted grandparents. We're late, and I'm supposed to be done, but I'm not skipping this step, because the first time I taught this was with 300 pastors in Ukraine, and it was a divided group. There were folks in their 70s and 80s, and then there were 20s and 30s, and not much in between. And the older pastors, most of them had spent some time in prison because of their ministry. And this younger group had very little respect for the older group. They're like, stop talking about communism. I know it was terrible, but it's over now. Move on. And if you don't switch your music, nobody our age is ever going to come to your church. They were really disrespectful. And the older people looked at those younger pastors and goes, they've never even been tested. We don't even trust them because we don't even know if they believe because they've never had to pay a price. I'd never follow a young leader like that. And it was polarized. I did something that I'm going to ask you to do. That we're going to divide it at over 50 and 50 and under, okay? If you are over 50, I want you to somehow make it to this side of the room, because this is what I did with the pastors. And 50 and under, you go to that side of the room. Just stand up. Do that quickly, if you're able. You know what? Wait a minute. We're not even going to move. This is too complicated. Just wait. Just wait. I put them on opposite sides of the room, and then I went in the balcony and go, Lord, I didn't want to do this. This is not going to work. It worked. What I'm going to ask you to do is, if you are 50 and under, I want you to find somebody over 50 who's near you. I want you to go to them. Wait. Don't do it yet. Don't do it yet. And I want you to thank them. Listen to me. I want you to thank them for their faithfulness. They've run their leg of the relay really well. Some of them are actually still running. They're some of the youngest older people here this week that are freaking me out. Okay? But I want you to thank them for their faithfulness. And then those of you who are older, I'd love for you to just place a hand on that younger person and pray God's blessing on their lives. So a prayer of thanks from younger to older, a prayer of blessing from older to younger. Go for it. Quickly. Go. Sorry, I'm late. Okay. You all mix up with them. Some of you are still praying, and that's good. What you just experienced, if you're still praying, that's okay. If you're talking, you should listen to Phil right now. If you're talking to my boss, that's okay. What you just experienced, even more so, is what God did in Ukraine. When the younger people humbled themselves and gave respect, the tears came. And when the older people then prayed for the younger pastors, it was amazing, and we've seen God do that in the Middle East. We've seen him do it in South America. A very conservative group of pastors was at a training conference, and the man who's kind of like the bishop of this denomination, God broke his heart. And he said, I've done nothing but try to limit my son's ministry. And he says, last night I confessed that, and I said, I'm going to be his main fan, all this through a translator. And I said, you called him last night? And he said, no. He says, this is my son right here. And he goes, see, I didn't even introduce him as my son because I don't like the way he does ministry. But he goes, that changed last night. These issues live in your church. If you think this was a neat activity here, I dare you to try it with your own family. I dare you. Because God will do something beautiful. Father, thank you so much for this morning. Thank you that as we're taking the principles that we learned yesterday and talking about today, all about their application, your Spirit has been obviously present amongst us. And I pray that you would show us how does this translate into our local church, and Lord, even more so, what are the implications of this for our family? In the awesome name of Jesus Christ, who is relevant for every generation, we pray. Amen.